Pleasure to introduce Bill Wootes. Bill Wootes is visiting from an institute for a number of months. He'll be here until mid-December. Bill Wootes is one of those figures in the foundations of quantum theory. You've had an important influential impact on the founding of the field of quantum information. With Project Zurich, discovered the no cloning theorem. An important theorem that in quantum foundations of quantum information. He was one of the co-authors on the paper on quantum teleportation, which in some respects founded the field of quantum information, subject and its thinking of quantum entanglement as a resource. Bill did his PhD at the University of Texas. At the same time, John Wheeler was there. He went on to do a two-year postdoc with John Wheeler, where he worked on the question that John Wheeler famously put, why the quantum? You'll try to reconstruct quantum theory from some more basic principles. Since then, he's been at Williams College, which is in Williamsburg. And today he's going to speak on where does nature like the square root of negative one?
Thanks very much, Jason. It's great to be here at Perimeter Institute this fall. We'll be here for another month or so. And that question there doesn't look like a very scientific question, I guess. Why does nature like the square root of negative one? Talking about nature's personal preferences, not very scientific. What I really mean by that is, in quantum mechanics, quantum theory, the complex numbers play this special role. Probability amplitudes are complex numbers. And I'm imagining that someday we'll have a theory, a deeper theory, that explains the structure of quantum theory, and in particular, explains the role of complex numbers. And I'm looking for clues as to what's going on here. In fact, what I'll be doing here, the very next slide is to try to make the question more modest, to get down to what I'm actually going to be doing in the talk. So the motivating question is there a theory yet to be discovered that will explain the structure of quantum mechanics, particularly the role of complex numbers? Not the question I'm asking is, how do empirical observations lead us to a theory with complex probability amplitude? There are plenty of empirical reasons for using complex numbers in quantum mechanics. There's a reason why the theory has the structure that it does. That's not the question I'm asking here. I'm wondering if you were creating a universe from scratch, why would you choose to make it this way as opposed to some other way? And now the actual question I'll be addressing here, or something closer to it, is are there qualitative differences between the real vector space version of quantum theory and actual complex vector space quantum theory that might give us some clues to the origin of the complex vector space structure? And in fact, what I will actually do is a little more modest than that. I will discuss three specific questions to which the real and complex theories give very different answers. You might think that theories are pretty much the same in many respects, but there are three ways in which they're qualitatively different that I'll be talking about here. They all have an information theoretic flavor. I'll say what the questions are in just a moment. So here, just to say what I'm talking about, here are the two theories I'm comparing. And in this talk, I'm going to confine my attention to the finite dimensional versions of these theories. So pure states are represented by rays in the real case, rays in a real vector space. Or you could use a unit vector, but plus and minus the unit vector count as the same state. In the complex case, rays in a complex vector space. But you can use a unit vector, but then if you multiply by a phase factor, it counts as the same state, same pure state. Measurements, complete orthogonal measurements, are represented by orthogonal bases in both cases. Reversible evolution in the complex case is unitary transformations on the space. In the real case, it would just be the unit determinant orthogonal transformations, so just rotations in the real vector space. Mixed states would be positive unit trace operators in both cases, but here they would be real matrices, here they're complex matrices, but here they're Hermitian, here they're symmetric. And the compensation rule in both cases is by the tensor product. So the space when you take bring two things together, you take the tensor product over vector spaces to get the space for the bigger system. And I want to say right off the bat that these two theories can simulate each other. Schicklberg noticed in 1960 that if you simply, he didn't say it in these terms, but for the finite case, finite dimensional case, you'd say it this way. Simply double the dimension of the real vector space, and then there's enough space there to do the complex, to find the complex theory there. You just have to, but if you simply double the dimension and use the real vector space theory in that bigger space, then you have all of the orthogonal rotations, all the rotations in that bigger space. Well, that's more than you wanted. That's more than the things that you're actually allowed in nature. And so you have to impose some restriction on what kind of transformations are possible. And Stukenberg showed how to do that. It's quite simple. But there is a restriction there. These two theories can also simulate each other locally, as was shown recently by McKay, Mosca, and Giuzana. You can, in this way of thinking, you basically add another binary object that's universal here. You can add binary objects, but they can be local. You can simulate it locally. But as in both, no matter how you're doing the simulation, you have to restrict the simulating theory in order to not get too many possibilities, like too many transformations. So I think the two theories have to be regarded as distinct theories. They can be distinguished by what they allow. One theory will allow something that the other will not. And there are a few of the other people who address this kind of question. There's a long tradition in quantum logic of coming up with axioms that would uniquely give us quantum theory. This is sort of, this follows some earlier work where here you end up with a vector, a theory over a vector space over the reals or complexes or quaternions. The complex numbers are picked out here over the reals by an insistence that there be an uncertainty principle. This is a question that has been thought of before and been worked on before. I'll mention some of these others later. I'm going to take kind of an information theoretic approach to it. So in the case of a single binary object, here's the distinction between the two theories. In the complex case, so let's take photon polarization as our example, which I'll use a few times. Those pure states are in one-to-one correspondence with the points on the surface of the sphere. So here are the linear polarization states around that gray circle. There's right circular polarization, left circular polarization, and then the other states on the surface are elliptical polarizations. Those are the states available. The mixed states are the interior of the sphere. In the real case, you just don't have that third dimension. You have linear polarizations, or you can think of it this way, you have linear polarizations, but no elliptical or circular polarization. There's the completely unpolarized state right there in the middle. So the mixed states are in the interior of the circle. Okay. And here are the three questions I want to bring up in this talk. Even though I'm not going to, at the end of this hour, I'm not going to have told you why nature likes complex numbers, I'm afraid. I will have answered these questions. And I hope you'll find that kind of interesting. Okay, so first question is, how well is information about a pure state expressed in the outcomes of an orthogonal dimension? That's question number one. Question number two is, two and three have to do with multipartite case. Are multipartite states locally accessible? One question. Another one is entanglement monogamous. So here we go. We'll jump right ahead to the first question. How well is information about a pure state expressed in the outcomes of an orthogonal measurement? And the little thing up in the corner here, it will say sometimes R or C to help you keep track of whether I'm talking about the real theory or the complex theory in case I forget to explicitly say I'm making a transition from one to the other. So I can always tell where they are. So here I'm talking about the reals theory. And I'd like to consider this very simple scenario. I've got a linear polarizer oriented with an angle theta, and it's producing photons with that polarization. And then over here is a polarizing beam splitter, and every photon has to make a decision to go to the vertical or horizontal polarization. It's a remarkable fact about quantum mechanics that there is no device over here that simply measures theta. So you can't send a photon through here, oh, this has a particular theta. There's no device over here, as you know, that it can just measure theta. An orthogonal measurement only has two outcomes. And so you don't get that much information about theta just by measuring a single photon. This is such a basic thing in quantum mechanics that one might wonder, what's the connection between theta? I wonder informationally, what's the connection between theta and what you get out over here? Well, as I said, with a single photon, you don't get much. If you send n photons and just count how many go this way and how many go this way, you can learn something about theta. Because the probability of vertical is the cosine squared of theta. So by measuring how many go vertical, what frequency, what fraction go vertical, you can read off that you got theta either here or here. So you learn something about theta. But in this problem, I'm going to imagine that you have a limited number of photons, okay, just say 100 or 1,000, which means that there are going to be, because of statistical fluctuations, you won't be able to pin it down exactly. So you won't pin down theta exactly. So you'll have, like, you'll measure, this is the actual frequency of occurrence of vertical. And so you say, well, most likely the theta is here, or it's here, because those are the ones that are consistent with what you saw. But there are others that are consistent with what you saw, because there's this kind of a statistical uncertainty region, which gets smaller and smaller as you run more trials, but it never goes to zero, except in the limit. And so you always have this little fuzzy region. So at the end of this 100 photons, or however many photons you've sent, you have a distribution of theta that's going to be peaked at these two places, but not a delta function. And I want to try to measure how well have we done at estimating theta by running these photons through and counting how many go vertical. Well, a reasonable measure of how well we've done is the mutual information between theta and the number of verticals. So that's what this thing is here. It's the mutual information between the value of theta and the value of the number of photons that went vertical. You can interpret this as the amount of information you learn, amount of Shannon information you learn about theta from looking at n vertical. Now, I'm going to subtract off from that. This thing will get infinitely large as the number of trials goes to infinity. It goes as the log of the square root of n. So I'm going to subtract off something to keep that from happening. And so we're going to look at this difference. And then we're going to compare our world with other possible worlds. Okay, and here's the definition of mutual information. You'll notice, so it just depends on the probability of getting n verticals given the angle theta. And that, in turn, just depends on the probability of vertical given theta. This is an average over theta with all thetas uniformly distributed a priori. So a priori, I'm assuming that the theta is uniformly distributed. Okay, so let's compare our world with other possible worlds. So here's our world with this probability law. Okay, so you end up with some distribution like this for theta. Here's another conceivable world. It has a different probability law. Now, I'm not sure one can make a consistent, complete theory that gave you this law, but we can at least imagine a world where, for this particular experiment, might have this law. I'm going to try to argue that our law is the best law of all conceivable laws. Okay, so here is the... Here's what you measure. You measure this many verticals. So now your theta is confined to a region right here or over here. It looks like this law has done better than our law. It's got a narrower region for theta than with our actual world, okay? But you can see that that's not always going to be the case, because there are going to be some other values, like over here, where you get this particular value, and you're going to have a very big uncertainty in the value of theta.
Okay.
So what we want, but this mutual information basically averages over all the possible values of theta. And it turns out that when you do that, our world's probability law is in fact optimal. It's the very best. So this Born's rule, okay, the rule that goes from state to probability, has this wonderful optimizing property. It gives you, it's the best for conveying information about the angle to the measurer through the probabilities. And that's what one finds. There's this general look upper bound on the mutual information, which is achieved for our particular probability law, cosine squared of theta. You might wonder whether it's unique. Well, it's almost unique. Cosine squared of 2 theta would also work. Cosine squared of any number of theta would also work. Anything that has that basic shape will work. Okay. So that's kind of neat. Why does this work? So intuitively, the reason it works is that here, if you look at, say, two different cases, suppose here the probability of vertical is a half, here it's something bigger than a half. In each case, this region of uncertainty in theta has the same width. And that's because the binomial distribution gets narrower near the ends of the probability interval, according to this formula here. And the slope of the cosine squared curve gets shallower near the ends of the probability interval. And those two effects cancel each other out perfectly, so you get the same uncertainty in theta either way. It's this. So if you just take cosine squared of theta and take the derivative, you get that, which just matches this. So that's why it works. Okay, so that, I think, is a kind of cool thing about the Born rule applied to photon polarization. Does this work in higher dimension? So let's take the real vector space. I still have the R up there. I'm still talking about real vector space quantum mechanics. The real vector space case in higher dimensions. And so here you have your state vector. So there's some preparation, some pure preparation that's prepared at this state. You're going to run many, many copies of that prepared object through a measuring device, now three possible outcomes. It's an orthogonal measuring device. Basically, it corresponds to this basis here. You're measuring this orthogonal basis. And so you end up with some frequencies of occurrence of the three outcomes. But because it's a finite sample, there's the statistical fluctuations, and you've got this little fuzzy area, which then translates into a little fuzzy area over here, and you're not sure exactly what was the preparation. You have this uncertainty. But the real vector space quantum mechanics maximizes the amount of information transferred, and the reason, intuitive reason why it maximizes the amount of information transferred in a limited number of trials is that if you take this little region here and sort of map it back into here, what you find is that the uncertainty region around that state is a circle, and it's the same size circle no matter where you are in the state space. Okay, that's the reason why this works. So again, this probability rule, P, the probability equals the square of the amplitude, maximizes the information gained about the state vector compared with other conceivable probability rules, anything that you might imagine. And why it works is because of what I just said. The uncertainty in A is uniform and isotropic, regardless of where it is in the space. And this reflects something that's well known in the statistics, been known for a long time. If you have just this probability simplex here, and you imagine some fixed number of trials, and you get a certain frequency of occurrence, there will be a region of uncertainty in a finite number of trials. And that region of uncertainty depends on where you are in the simplex. If you're near the middle, it's big and round. If you're near the edge, it's squished. And if you're near the corner, it's really small. But if you just redraw the simplex so that the axes are the square roots of probability, then all the little regions of uncertainty are the same size,
okay,
and the same shape. They're all circles. So, then, as I say, this has been known for a long time, since the days of Fisher in statistics, and it's been used in statistics. Okay, so that was all real vector space quantum mechanics. Does this thing work? Does this information transfer, maximization of information transfer work in the complex case? So here's a single qubit, single photons polarization, when now the right-handed and left-handed circular polarizations are in there, all the electrical polarizations are in there. And is information maximized for this theory in the same sense? And the answer is no. So for if gamma is the angle measured from the North Pole, the probability of getting vertical, make a vertical versus horizontal measurement, is the cosine squared of gamma over 2, which sounds good because cosine squared was what worked before, but it was crucial in that earlier example that the angle theta be uniformly distributed a priori. And there's no justification for assuming a uniform distribution of gamma a priori. The natural uniform natural distribution would be uniform over the surface of a sphere, and that's not uniform over gamma. So this does not work. And what may be even worse is, at least worse for the spirit of this whole idea, is there's this extra variable here, this azimuthal variable, that's not probed at all by vertical versus horizontal measurements. So, and in general, in n dimensions, a pure state holds 2 times n minus 1 real parameters. That's how many real parameters it takes to specify the state. But a probability measurement, a complete measurement like this, an orthogonal measurement, only gives you half that many independent numbers. So you always can only get half. The state itself holds twice as much information as the measurement provides. Is there some simple underlying explanation of this doubling? That's what I'm wondering. This resonates with some work that's been done here. Rob Steckens has a toy model mimicking some aspects of quantum mechanics. And it's based on the idea that you must be ignorant of some things, that you can only know half of what's of the information that's there underneath. Philip Goyle has also done something very recently related to this, where he invokes complementarity. Complementarity is this doubling of the number of possible number of parameters. Okay, so that's the end of question number one. There's this difference between the real case and the complex case. And in this case, my opinion is that the real theory comes out better than the complex theory. It's more attractive, it's more appealing. And for me, this exasperates the question, you know, makes it even more urgent that we figure out what the heck nature is doing using complex numbers instead of real numbers, which would have been so much nicer in that context. Okay, so we move on to the next question, which is, and now I'm going to talk about mixed states, not pure states, of a multipartite system, bipartite at first, are mixed states locally accessible? Okay, let's start by talking about the state estimation for a single qubit. Okay, so again, I'm imagining we have many, many copies of a particular state. So you've got this device that's spitting out many, many copies of, maybe it's a laser, it's spitting out many photons, or it's something that's spitting out actually individual photons. And they might be in a mixed state. They might be in a not completely polarized state. And you're trying to figure out what that state is. Okay, so in other words, you're trying to locate the state somewhere in this sphere, maybe in the interior if it's mixed. Okay, so one way to do it, it's very simple and practical, would be to take a sub-ensemble of these photons that are coming your way and just measure the sub-ensemble in the vertical-horizontal basis. You measure vertical versus horizontal. You count how many go vertical, how many go horizontal, and if 80% are vertical, then you draw this plane that's 80% of the way from the bottom to the top, and you say the state lies somewhere on that plane. Now, here I'm not worrying about the statistical fluctuation. I'm now supposing we've got so many that we can narrowly, we can get that down to almost a plane. Okay, and then you take another sub-ensemble, and you measure the 45 degrees versus the other 45 degrees for the polarizing beam splitter, And that cuts your disk down to just a little line segment. And then you do a third measurement in the third direction, which would be a measurement of right circular versus left circular polarization. And you nail it down. And so that's how you can determine the state. So here is a summary of what I've just said. Here you've got your thing that produces these individual particles. You split them into three sub-ensembles. And here are the three measurements. I'm using the Pauli operators here. So we can just as well be thinking about spin, and it's convenient to think about the Pauli operators to indicate the measurements that you're doing. These three measurements in three different directions, which will pin down the state in the block sphere. Okay, to specify a density matrix, a 2x2 density matrix in this complex space, well, it has to be a Hermitian matrix, and it has to have unit trace. That means it's going to have three real parameters in it. And each measurement is supplying one parameter, and as we've seen, that pins it down. Okay. Now, to get to the real question that I'm asking, which is local accessibility. Suppose you have a device that spits out pairs of qubits, say pairs of photons, for example, or pairs of spin 1/2 particles, and you're trying to measure the spin state of these pairs of spin 1/2 particles. A naive way to approach this would be to say, I'm just going to do what I did for the individual particles, okay? But I'm going to do it on both sides. I'll do it for these guys, and I'll do it for these guys, and thereby try to figure out what the state of the pairs is. Okay, so you do it on this side, and you get you do exactly what we said before, the same thing over here. But now you can also pay attention to correlations. You can say, what's the probability that this one will give the plus outcome while this one also gives the plus outcome? Okay, and let's just count how many parameters we get in this way. From this kind of measurement, well, you can do a few things. You can say, just look at this regardless of the left-hand side. Just don't look at the left-hand side and say, what's the probability of the plus or minus outcomes here? And that's one number. Here's another number, the probability of plus here. The probability of plus here is another number that you get. And then you can similarly do the same thing over here and not pay attention to the right-hand side. Get three more numbers that way. And then you also have that you can measure, as I was saying, the probability of this and this, okay, or the probability of this going this way and this one going this way. And that gives you 9 more independent numbers, because of 3 times 3, and they are associated with these particular matrices that figure into the density matrix. What you're actually finding is the coefficients of these matrices in the density matrix. So you have 3 plus 3 plus 9 parameters, which is 15, which is the number you needed. Why is that the number you needed? Because it's a Hermitian matrix that's got unit trace, and so there are 4 squared real numbers to determine a 4x4 Hermitian matrix, and then this is for the unit trace, and so you have 15 numbers to find, and you can find 15 numbers. This is not a trivial fact at all, that you can locally reconstruct the state in quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics is non-local in some ways, but not in this way. In this way, it's local. It's locally accessible. I want to introduce a different way of counting the very same kind of scenario, which I learned from Lucy and Hardy. It's more convenient, especially for when you get to more complicated cases. Instead of thinking about a normalized density matrix, let's think of an unnormalized. I'll use prime to indicate that the density matrix is not normalized, maybe subnormalized. And the way you imagine that is you have this box here, you press a button, and a pair of qubits may or may not come out. Okay, so you press the button, maybe nothing will come out, or maybe a pair of qubits will come out. And so you represent in the density matrix doesn't have unit trace, it has something less than unit trace, and the trace of the density matrix is simply the probability that something will come out when you press the button. Okay, it's as simple as that. And the reason for doing that is that it's very convenient for the counting of parameters. So in this particular case, and what I've done here is I've replaced those binary measurements with filters. So this is a filter that only allows the positive x direction to go through positive y direction, positive z direction. This is the identity, which allows everything to go through, but you can use that to figure out what's the probability that when you press the button, you'll get something. In other words, you can use the outcomes of this to figure out the normalization of the state, to figure out what is the trace. And that's just a little bit easier for the counting because you don't have to subtract the 1 for one thing. You have now a Hermitian matrix, it has to be positive definite still. It has 16 real parameters to specify it. And here you get four measurements over here. You can do them in any combination, and each one gives you one parameter. So you have 4 times 4, 16 parameters. Here, sigma naught is the identity matrix. The other sigmas are the Pauli matrices. And that gives you all the coefficients in rho prime. Okay, and this generalizes to no matter how big the system is, I have a system with n1 dimensions and a system with n2 dimensions. I've tried to reconstruct the state of the pair. Well, local measurements will give me all exactly as many numbers as I need. They'll give me exactly what I need. It's the same kind of argument. Local measurements give you sort of this many on one side, this many on the other side. If you take all the combinations, you get exactly the number that you need for the state of the pair. So in the complex case, measurements on the parts with attention paid to the correlations provide exactly the information you need to construct the density matrix of the whole. Now I've shifted to the real case. Let's just see how it goes in the real case. Real case is easier. You just have a circle instead of a sphere. So how do you do it? Well, with one sub-ensemble, you can measure vertical versus horizontal. Another sub-ensemble, you measure how many go this way as opposed to this way. And that's it. And you're done. You've got your state. Here's a summary of that process. It's easier than we had before. There are only 2 sub-ensembles, 2 measurements. You get 2. Each measurement provides 1 parameter. You only need 2, and you're done. Now let's go to Lucien's way of writing that, which would be you'd have an unnormalized state. Well, that will require 3 parameters, and this one here is just to figure out what the normalization is, which is what's the probability when you press the button something will come out. Okay, now let's do a pair of rebits. So this is producing a pair of rebits, and we're doing the unnormalized version. So you have to figure out the trace. That's one of the parameters you have to figure out. And you just do the same thing. You just do something, what we did before. We do it again over here. Pay attention to the correlations. How many parameters do we get? How many do we need? The number we need is the number of free parameters in a 4x4 symmetric matrix, not with any particular trace. Well, that's 4 times 5 divided by 2, which is 10 real parameters is what you need. How many do you get? Well, you have all possible combinations of this and this. And that's 3 times 3, which is 9 parameters. And you don't get everything that you need. And in fact, you can't. No matter how you modify its local measurements, you can't figure out the state from local measurements alone because there is this missing piece. Sigma y, the Pauli sigma y matrix, is an imaginary matrix in the usual representation, and so it's not allowed over here. It's not something you can do on a single rebit because it's not real. But sigma y tensor sigma y is a real matrix. That can be part of the density matrix that's being produced here. It's perfectly legal. It just can't be accessed locally. The people would have to bring these two rebits back together or something like that and make a joint measurement on them in order to figure out what's the coefficient of that in the density matrix. That's what they're missing. Okay, and this goes up to this also works in higher dimensions too. On the other hand, in the real theory, at least all states are bilocally accessible. What does that mean? It means suppose. So it's not locally accessible. In the real theory, you can't access the whole state just by measuring the parts. No matter how fancy measurements you make, if you're measuring only the parts, you can't figure out what the state of the whole is. The parts don't determine the whole. On the other hand, if you're allowed to measure the parts and also pairs of parts, then you can determine the whole, as it turns out. Okay? And this works in any dimension, and I'll show you sort of how this works. So imagine you have three, these are real real vector space objects with dimensions n1, n2, and n3. Let k of n be the number of parameters that an unnormalized state with n dimensions has, number of real parameters in that state. Then let's count how many parameters we can access. So of this whole thing, we would need the k of the product in 1 and 2 and 3. Well, let's just start making measurements and see how many we access. So here's the number of parameters accessible bilocally. Bilocally means you're allowed to measure two things at the same time. Okay, first you can measure things one at a time. That is to say, you measure just local measurements on this, along with this and this, and you pay attention to the correlations among those. That gives you this many parameters. So this is the number of parameters associated with here, with this one, and then multiply that by the others. This is like what we've just been doing. That's how many parameters. If you were doing local measurements in quantum mechanics itself, in the complex theory, this would be sufficient. This would give you everything you need. But it's not in the real case. So you also have the possibility of making this joint measurement on these two while paying attention to correlations with the measurement with measurements on this one. Well, the joint measurement on these two gives you this many parameters that you didn't have before, because this is how many you could have gotten locally, but this is how many you get jointly. And the difference is how many new parameters there are from the joint measurement. You get to multiply that by the number of parameters associated with this measurement here, because you're looking at the correlations. And so altogether, you get this many more parameters from your measurement. And you can keep going. You can make this kind of measurement, get this many parameters, do it again. And so that adds up. So this here is the total number of parameters you could get bilocally. If we allowed trilocal measurements, where you could actually bring all three together and measure them jointly, they'd get more. Okay, but we're not allowing this. We're saying we're at least limiting it to bilocality. It turns out for the real case, for the k of n of the real quantum mechanics, real vector space quantum mechanics, this combination is exactly the same as the number that you need to reconstruct the state. And now you can ask, does this go the other way around? If it's the same, exactly the same as what you need, does that give you real vector space quantum mechanics? Well, it doesn't necessarily. There are a bunch of k of n's that have this property, but the first ones are very familiar. K of n equals n is what you have for ordinary probability, where the number of parameters is the same as the number of distinct states. There's a probability for each one. That's ordinary probability theory. This is real vector space quantum mechanics. And that's allowed. That's by this bilocal thing. This is ordinary quantum mechanics, which is also allowed. Yes, it's bilocally accessible because it's also locally accessible. And then you have this general, maybe some other theories that we haven't thought about, where k, the number of parameters in a state with dimension n, has this form. So it's a class of theories that are bilocally accessible. If you change that to local accessible, then you rule out, as we've seen, you rule out the real vector space theory. You also rule out a bunch of these. And you have these guys left. You know, ordinary probability theory, you've got quantum theory, and you've got a bunch of others. This came out in Lucien's paper on his axioms that uniquely specify quantum theory. It's other axioms that will rule out these guys and this one. So in this sense, the real vector space theory is more non-local or more holistic than actual everyday quantum theory that we're used to. And that might not have been obvious. You might think the real theory would be simpler in a way, but it's more non-local. Okay, here's my third question. Is entanglement monogamous? Okay, it's well known in quantum information theory circles that entanglement is monogamous. if two particles are entangled with each other completely, neither one can be entangled with anything else. And this is called monogamy in the literature. And for reasonable reasons. Okay, so here it is in a complex case. Entanglement in a complex case. So here is, I'm talking about two qubits here. So it's C for complex. And here's an entangled state. This state is maximally entangled. To create it, you need to if you start from scratch, starting with someone over here and someone over here, they can't create this state by talking on the phone. They can create this state by sending an actual qubit from one person to the other. And to create 10 of them, they have to send 10 qubits. To create 100, they have to send 100 qubits. It's maximally entangled in that sense. Now let's consider mixed state entanglement, again, in the complex case, because that's important for this monogamy question. So let's consider a density matrix, which is a probabilistic mixture of this entangled state and that entangled state, but with equal probabilities. So it could be prepared by just preparing this state or this state, and you just don't know which one you've prepared. You toss a coin to decide which one, and you forget which one you did. That would be this density matrix here. Now, one might think this mixture is also maximally entangled, because it's a mixture of maximally entangled states. How are they going to prepare it? I mean, Alice over here could prepare one of those states locally, but then she'd have to send one of the qubits to Bob, and then they'd have the state. And that would take sending a qubit. So you might think it's maximally entangled, because it takes sending a qubit to create it. But no, the same density matrix can also be written as an equal mixture of this state, which is a product state, and this state, which is another product state. So Alice and Bob, at their two different locations, could prepare these individually. They just talk on the phone to decide whether to do this one or this one, and then they forget which one they've got, and so they end up with a mixture of these two. That can be created locally just by that method. So therefore, we say this state row is unentangled. So the mixture of these two, even though it looks like a mixture of entangled states, is unentangled, because there's another way of making it involving unentangled states. So entanglement monogamy, you can say this way. This is the statement, or this is one statement of it. If A and B are maximally entangled, then neither can be at all entangled with C. And the reason, basically, is that if either A or B were entangled at all with C, then the state AB would not be a pure state. It would be somewhat mixed, at least. And it's just a fact that in the complex theory, a maximally entangled state must be pure. Any kind of mixture you have, you can do the kind of trick we just did and see that it's not maximally entangled. Now I switch to the real case, to the real vector space case. And let's consider, again, the very same mixture. Mixture of this entangled state, entangled pure state, and this entangled pure state with equal weights. Yeah, these are two rebits, two real binary objects. How entangled is that mixture? And what's a little surprising is that the mixture, or surprising if you've been thinking about the complex case, is the mixture, this mixture is maximally entangled. It's maximally entangled because there's no alternative decomposition such as this one, which gives you the same density matrix in the real vector space theory. Because see, that's not allowed. That's I, and you're not allowed to have that. So this combination is not allowed, and you can easily show that there is no combination except for a pair of maximally entangled states. So in the real vector space theory, a mixed state can be maximally entangled. And you have no entangled monogamy in the real case. It's related to this mixed state being not maximally entangled. So here's a state of three rebits. You can see it involves the sigma y. The sigma y, which is imaginary, but because it always comes in pairs, this is real. And this is a perfectly legal density matrix. It has rank 2. It's not pure. It's mixed but with rank 2. The reduced 2 rebit state looks like this. This is basically this is also a mixed state, but it's maximally entangled. It's basically the state that I've been talking about. It's a mixed state that's maximally entangled. And because of the symmetry, each pair is in this maximally entangled state. So you have 3 things that are maximally entangled. This goes on forever. There is hardly any limit to the, what's the word? What's the opposite of monogamy?
Polygamy.
Polygamy.
Polygamy,
I guess. Yeah. Right. I guess that's the word. Yes, there's no limit to what these rebits will do. So here I have 5 rebits, and they're all having affairs with each other. And they're all maximally entangled with each other. Okay, so here is the state, in case you want to see what the state is. If you don't want to see it, don't look at it. Actually, it's not just one state. Here are 2 to the n minus 1. There are n rebits. So n is 5 in that picture. There are 2 to the n minus 1 distinct states. They're all orthogonal to each other. And they all have this property that they're maximally entangled pairwise. Okay, so this is an outrageous violation of entanglement monogamy. Not just one state that does it. Even one state could be an outrageous violation. But there are a whole bunch of states that have this property. One of you is asking, what could you do with this? If we lived in this real vector space world, could we do anything cool with it? Could we do some kind of cool teleportation or something? You can't do any cool teleportation, but you can hide data very well. Okay, so if you wanted to hide n minus 1 bits in here, you could just prepare one of these 2 to the n minus 1 states, stick these rebits in that state, and then these participants located at the different sites here can talk to each other all they want, and they won't be able to get a single one of those n minus 1 bits out of there. So this is great for data hiding. It's not our world, so we can't do it. But if we lived in that world, we could use it. Okay, now I'm going to summarize. Those are the 3 questions. I'm summarizing here the results of those 3 questions. So in our first question about the transmission of information from preparation to measurement, in the complex case, an orthogonal measurement can only access half the parameters of a pure state. In the real case, information about a pure preparation is not only accessible, but optimally expressed. And maybe I'm the one, maybe no one is more impressed by this than I am, or as impressed by this as I am. But for some reason, it strikes me as telling us something. But in this theory, the information is optimally passed on from measurement to, or from preparation to measurement in the real case, not in the complex case. In the complex case here, we're talking about accessibility of multipartite states. Complex. They are locally accessible, despite all of the non-locality in quantum mechanics, despite Bell's theorem and all that other stuff. Accessibility is local. You can actually figure out what a state is just by measuring the parts. You can have many copies. Whereas in the real case, it's not locally accessible, but it is bilocally accessible. Okay, it's the next level up in non-locality. For a question about entanglement monogamy, entanglement is strictly monogamous in the complex case and not at all in the real case. Okay, so here's a tentative conclusion. What conclusion can we draw about the world on the basis of the answers to these information theoretic questions? Well, this is very tentative. So maybe what's going on, this complexness of quantum mechanics, may be telling us to what extent nature is limited in its non-locality or its holism. Okay, we don't have an extremely holistic theory, just a slightly holistic theory, slightly non-local theory. The real case would be more holistic, more non-local, and so maybe this complex is telling us something about the degree of holism in our theory. Still, though, that kind of conclusion, limited holism, and by the way, this is indeed, in Lucian's axioms, This is what rules out the real vector space case. It's the fact that it's not bilocally accessible, not locally accessible. The states are not locally accessible. But this limited holism still does not give us a direct answer to this question that I asked earlier, and I still wonder about why does a complete orthogonal measurement access only half the parameters of a pure state? Where's this factor of two coming from? There must be some simple way of understanding it, or at least there must be a deeper way of understanding it, I would think. Now, let's see. Before I end, though, I'll just take one more minute, because I have some time, to kind of go back to that first question. Let's see. Is there any way we can, since I like it so much, I like this information efficiently transmitted from preparation to measurement in the real vector space case, can we actually see anything like that in the complex vector space case, where we could say, yes, yes, in the complex vector space case, you also have this efficiency in a certain sense. Okay, well, here's my try at that. It's a kind of a weak try, but here it is. Suppose we modify the scenario. Instead of having preparation and measurement, we consider the following scenario. Here is a maximally entangled state. So we've prepared many copies of that. One component of each copy goes directly to this measuring device here. The other component goes through a unitary transformation, and then it goes to the measuring device. And what's the measuring device? It's a measuring device that distinguishes between among these four mutually orthogonal states, each of which is maximally entangled. Okay, so what's nice about this thing is that as opposed to the preparation measurement scenario of my opening question, this is a little bit more relational. The goal is not to figure out what's the preparation. The goal now is trying to figure out what was this transformation. So what was the transformation that you did? And the only access you have is by counting how many these four lights here are the four lights that can light up when you do the measurement. So you do a limited number of trials, and you get you count how many give you this outcome, how many give you this outcome, how many this outcome, and how many this outcome. And from those frequencies of occurrence, you try to reconstruct what was the unitary. And the question is information at least maximally conveyed from here to these outcomes through the probabilities in this scenario, as it was in the real vector space case when you went from preparation to measurement? And the cool thing is that it does work in this example. It does work in this example. That is, you do have this maximum transmission of information from here to here. For this case, and then I hasten to add, actually I wish I didn't have to hasten to add, that the obvious generalization of this to higher dimensions does not work. So that's why it's kind of a thought. Okay, and I think that is where I want to end, so thanks a lot for listening.
Why doesn't the generalization of that to higher dimensions not work? Isn't it just tensor-assisted process tomography?
It is indeed, but the problem is that SU2 is a sphere, and SU3 is not. And it's the spherical nature. If you remember, when you turn the probability simplex into a sphere, you get these nice properties.
Does that mean ancillary-assisted process tomography only works for the single qubit system then?
Oh, no, not at all. It's that it only works optimally
okay. In
this sense of optimal. But in real life, I mean, that doesn't stop anyone. you can do it.
Which a priori, which probability distribution were you using in the U?
Oh, yeah. The Haar measure.
That is
the unique invariant measure on SU2.
You talked about complexes versus reals. Has there been anything on more exotic fields?
Like
quaternion?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's been a fair amount of work on quaternionic quantum mechanics, too. Stephen Adler has written a book on it. Right. And I remember there were some tests carried out some years ago to see whether there was evidence of quaternionic. Of course, there was not, or otherwise we would all know that.
So regarding the monogamy question,
Is
there anything you can say about the difference between the complex and the real case when we don't use a maximum in complex?
The difference between the complex and real case.
Yeah,
when we don't use a maximum candlestick. That's a great question. So in the case of the complex theory, that we have these. It's partial. So monogamy is a funny word because you can have these guys be partly entangled. And as long as they're not maximally entangled, this guy can be a little bit entangled with this one. And so there's this trade-off.
But the bound on the trade-off is not very strict, right? It's not like you can read out how much entanglement there is with the third party knowing the entanglement between the first two.
Oh, that is true. That's not so easy. Yeah, it's nice to... this question is nice, where you're asking... What's the entanglement between these two and these two and these two and these two?
So they don't sum up to a constant in the complex case. I'm asking, in the real case, what happens?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer, but it's worth looking at. And I'm also wondering, so in this case, this is great. These entanglements basically have to add up to something, or can't be bigger than when you add them all up in the right way, you can't exceed a certain. But in the real case, obviously you can. Exceed that. There's no such limit. On the other hand, I'm wondering if there's something about entanglement monogamy in the real case that corresponds to its bilocal accessibility. I mean, you see, the bilocal accessibility is a limitation on the locality, on the non-locality. You never have to measure three things at once. Mm-hmm. It's sufficient to measure two things at once. Well, I wonder if there's something similar over here. Like, for example, consider a three-way entanglement of three rebits. Maybe there's a monogamy of three-way entanglement in the rebit case that would be correspond to the fact that you don't need three-way measurements in the tomography.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it probably is something like that, but I just haven't had a chance to work it out.
There's another Clifford algebra called pseudo-complex. I have about complex numbers.
I'm sorry.
Omega squared is plus one instead of minus one. Pseudo-complex numbers.
Pseudo-complex numbers where what?
Algebra. So what happens if you take quantum mechanics with those numbers?
Okay, so the numbers again are?
Omega squared is plus one, not minus one. It's a Clifford algebra.
Okay.
What happens to Douglas interference, Douglas Smith experiment? Omega squared is not omega. It's a complex quantity.
Oh, okay.
There are five of these. This is in addition to quaternion algebra.
Oh, I see. I don't know. I don't know the answer. That's interesting. And it's interesting also to see how those versions of the theory would fit in with some of the quantum logic work that's been done. There's some work that, if you assume enough assumptions, you narrow it down to just the reals, complexes, and quaternions. So if you back off a bit, it might open up some of the ones that you're talking about. But I don't know.
If you look at the information processing capabilities of quantum theory relative to classical theory,
you
find all these nice advantages.
Like yes, absolutely. Yeah,
distribution, computation speedups, and those you can all do with real quantum mechanics.
Absolutely. In fact, if you have n real quantum bits, it's enough to add one more bit, n real bits, real vector space bits, you add one more bit, you've got all the capabilities of n qubits.
So I'm wondering, if you gave an example of something you could do in a real quantum mechanics world, information processing task that you couldn't do in a quantum world, that's hiding data from people who have classical communication.
Right.
Are there any examples of things that you can do better in a quantum world?
Than in the real world?
Or if maybe just, you know, get some figure of merit is improved in the quantum world because you have the whole block sphere rather than just a plane?
That's a great question. Let me think.
Like random access code or something? Maybe random access codes?
Random access codes? Yeah. Is that...
I'm wondering if it's not obvious to be able to do as well.
I'm not sure. By the way, I'm sorry, I'm not answering your question. When I don't know the answer, I'll answer a different question.
probably more interesting.
You might have asked. well, because of these limitations, hey, what about bit commitment? Bit commitment can't be done in complex quantum mechanics, right? In ordinary quantum mechanics. And the reason it can't be done is you have an entangled state, you can always turn it to any other entangled state locally. That's the problem. So here, we have this entangled state in the real case that if you rotate either one of the rebits, it doesn't change the state at all. You don't go to some other entangled state. So it looks like you could do bit commitment in this case. But unfortunately, actually, it's a moot point since we don't live in this world, but you can't do it because with an ancilla, it turns out you can actually get to a difference. You can change the state to a different state, to one of the other states. So unfortunately, you still can't do Bitcoin. Yeah, but Joe?
Oh, yeah, so it's this funny sigma y times sigma y term buys you some special form of entanglement, right? And, I mean, is it possible to maybe change your approach where you would change the tensor product composition rules or disallow things like sigma y, tensor sigma y?
That's an interesting question. I don't think you can do that, but I haven't thought about it maybe hard enough. That is, if you disallowed that, that means that there's some states that live in the space that you just say are not they're illegal states.
But you maybe being like a subspace, when you compose systems, you'd be making some
subspace. It's a subspace of the space of matrices.
Yeah.
Subspace of the space. But then what are the pure states? And it's a great question. My guess is that one would run into some problems. That one would run into something. You'd say, oh, no, this is completely unacceptable. But I haven't worked it out. I haven't figured it out. Someone may have.
This may be a little bit outside the topic of this lecture, but I was just wondering what kind of atoms and stuff like that do you get from real quantum mechanics?
What kind of atoms? yeah, it's tricky. Well,
because
now you're talking about the continuous case.
Right.
Right. And also, what would the Schrodinger equation look like?
Right.
It's got an I in it. And that is a problem. An easy answer is if the way we're going to model one of these real particles, a particle in real vector space quantum mechanics, in a continuum, we could model it this way. We could say its state space is the space of square integral real functions, tensor product with a two-dimensional real vector space. And the reason I say that is that once you do that, you open up the whole world of the complex. I mean, everything that was available to you before is still available to you. So you can have atoms the way we ordinarily have atoms. The thing is, though, this would allow some other things to happen besides what ordinary quantum mechanics allows, because the orthogonal transformations in the space, that's bigger than the unitary transformations in our usual quantum mechanics. But exactly what does it allow? What funny things could happen? I remember David Bohm addresses this partly in his textbook. He says you would have you'd have ordinary momentum states, but you'd also have these crazy states where even when the momentum is well-defined, the particle is going in both directions. So you might have all sorts of weird things happening.
I guess to do a special case of this question, if I wanted to know about like single spin systems in real quantum mechanics, I could imagine I might do the same thing that I do in ordinary quantum mechanics, where I look for representations of the rotation symmetry group, and then like from that construct uniquely, or almost uniquely, what the state space can look like, and then I figure out what my observables are, because, and so forth. Can we do the same thing in real quantum mechanics, where I again get this like almost unique set of state spaces, and the observables are, like I can figure out what my observables have?
I'm not sure I understand. So for spin 1/2, you just have this one. I mean, the rotation group would be this U1.
Right. So in ordinary quantum mechanics, I can say I need a representation of SO3. Well, not exactly SO3.
Oh, okay, of SO3, right, because we live in three dimensions.
Right. And I need a representation of it on this complex vector space, and what can these representations look like, and that tells me everything about spin systems.
Right, yes, indeed.
Can we do the same thing in real, where I say now I need a representation of SO3 in a real vector space, which I guess is stupid, because it's just going to be SO3 itself.
Yeah. Right. So you won't have anything like spin 1/2 then. Right, because if it's a two-dimensional state space, you just get this circle. That's not looking like SO3. And then what would happen? You go to higher dimensions. Oh, well, okay. So spin one particle is fine because then you can rotate. That then you can just have sort of the simple representation of SO3. Well, I don't know the general question. I don't know the general answer. It's a good question. I want to keep exploring. What dimensions are allowed?
Maybe we should leave that. Let's Pratica build.